All right, let's begin. So tonight we have the continuation of our Great Controversies in Jewish History series. Tonight is really a fascinating time of our history, of our modern history, a very complicated part of our modern history, that of the Haganah, the Irgun, the Lechi. And when you think about all the different names and all the different groups, it's really an example of two Jews and three shuls. You have trying to keep it all straight as to who is who, just between the names, the Haganah, the Irgun, known as the Eitzel. You have the Lechi, also called the Stern Gang. You have the Palmach. Why would a Jew living in Palestine in the 1930s or 40s, what would make them join or support one group versus another? What did each one represent? What were the philosophical underpinnings, their objectives, and their goals? It's a complicated time in our history. So it's a fascinating time, as I mentioned. It's way more than we can cover in an hour. Just the history of these groups and what takes place in the late 20s, the 30s, and then the 40s primarily is fascinating. So we're going to cover the tip of the iceberg, historically speaking. What I'd like to try to focus on is the conflict, the controversy, the tension that existed in the Jewish world during this time period, what gave rise to these different groups and what each group represented, and what the outcome of these different groups are. So we'll try to focus on that. We're going to cover the history, obviously, as we go through, but there's no way we're going to cover an in-depth amount. There's just way too much to be able to do so. But let me frame it with a couple of introductory remarks. Number one is as follows. I'll ask a little bit of a provocative question of sorts. So I would imagine that everyone sitting in this room would identify in some level with Zionism or as a Zionist in all of its different forms and meanings over the course of this past century. But in its simplest form, as a lover and supporter of the modern state of Israel, in its form as part of the redemptive process, as we are watching this miracle unfold before our very eyes over the last 100 years, and we would very much all identify with that which is taking place. The question that I would then ask is, does that mean, as an avowed Zionist, that we believe that whatever the Zionist enterprise does is intrinsically correct? Is it intrinsically good or the right thing to do? And that becomes a very complicated question when one is in a passionate support of something from afar or even from up close, and then has to decide whether or not what's taking place is intrinsically aligned with Jewish ideals or values. And one might not agree or would agree, and then has to find himself balancing a stance of, I'm fully supportive of what's going on, and not agreeing with particular things along the way. And that's going to become a very complicated question as we discuss some of the things which take place over this period of time, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, in Palestine, pre-state Israel. The very first Rashi in Chumash, very, very first comment that Rashi makes is as follows. He asks a question. Why does the Torah begin with Bereishis? Why does the Torah begin with this story? Really, it should begin, it's a book of law, and as a book of law, it should begin with HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, the first mitzvah that the Jewish people are given as a nation. So why do we have Bereishis? So Rashi says a fascinating comment, which is really going to be the backbone of what we're talking about tonight. Says Rashi, do you know why the Torah starts with Bereishis? The Torah has to tell us the beginning, creation, to let us know that God created everything and that it's His. So that, says Rashi, if any nation will ever come and say, thieves to the Jewish people, you stole the land that you call home, you stole it from the inhabitants that had it when you got there. When Yehoshua, when Joshua leads the people across the Jordan River to take the land, who was living there at the time? There are 31 nations, 31 different nations that occupied that land. And you just came in here and conquered and killed and banished. You're thieves, they're going to say. Lest anyone say that, says Rashi, the Torah begins with a story of creation to say, Koach ma'asav yigidli amo, the power of his strength, he let everybody know, the whole world belongs to God. He gave land to whom he saw fit to give it to, when he saw fit to give it to him. And he took it from them when he saw fit to take it from them, and to give it to whom he saw, to whom it pleases. So that if anyone claims we're thieves, Hashem gave it to other nations at their time, and then he took it from them and gave it to us. That's the very first comment that every Jew starts off with when they open up a Chumash, that the land of Israel was once not ours, but Hashem saw fit to give it to us at an appropriate time.
If we try using this argument today, would anybody in the world listen to us?
Fair question. That's not for... I mean, this is going to be the background of our discussion. I mean, this is part of... That's why I'm starting with this. That's why I'm starting with this.
It's for us and not for them.
Okay, well, now, where do we see a proof of just from a week or two's Parsha? So Avram Avinu needs a burial plot for his wife, Sarah. What does he need to do to get it? He needs to buy it. Now, that's one of the tests of Avram. Why is this such a difficult test? So the Ramban describes on a couple of levels. Number one, he has to deal with the used car salesman like Ephraim to buy it. He's in a time of tremendous pain and mourning and loss. But there's another aspect, which is... this is my land. God promised me this entire land. And all I want is a little space to bury my beloved. And what do I need to do to get it? I need to buy it? I need to negotiate and go through this whole process? It's mine. But not yet. Not yet. And so the test was, can you maintain your cool, your calm, your respect to purchase that which you've been promised will be yours, but is not yet yours? That was the test. Now, so we would all agree to that. Before it was given, it wasn't his. He had to buy it. He had to play by the rules. He couldn't just steal it, right? That wouldn't be right. Fast forward. We're given the land. It's ours. We're exiled from it. 2,000 years. Whose land is it? Whose land is it? So we'd say on one level, it's ours. What do you mean? This is our land. God promised to Avram, to Yitzchak, and to Yaakov that this will be our land, an eternal heritage. This is our land. Except we have one little problem. We were exiled from the land. God kicked us off the land. What's our status? What's our relationship to the land during the time of exile? When it's controlled, ruled, the whole world thinks it belongs to someone else. And all the meanwhile, we say three times a day, Vili Yerushalayim, Ircha, Berachamim, Tashuv, bring us back home every year, Lashana Habab, Yerushalayim. This is our homeland, but someone else is on it. What status does it have? Can we take it by force and say, I'm only taking back that which is mine, or do I have to play by the rules? Like Avraham did before it was given to him. What do you say to that? Well, that's a complicated question. That's a complicated question. I'll add one more point, and then we'll actually start talking about what I told you I was going to talk about tonight. We've discussed several times before when we spoke about the early Zionist return. There's a famous Gemara that's often quoted about the three oaths that the Jewish people were required to take in exile. It's a piece of Agadata in the Talmud, not a halachic based, well, not according to most, of rabbinic literature, that there were three oaths that we took. If you remember those who were here, we discussed them. One was not to rebel against the nations of the world. That we took an oath not to rebel against the nations of the world and not to approach Israel like a wall, to en masse, as most of the commentators understand it, to en masse as a nation to retake the land against their authority. And the nations of the world took a vow not to overly exert too much pain and suffering on us. So there's a series of oaths that we took. So many ask the question, now that we look back in history, that we now have the land again, did we violate any of the oaths not to take the land by storm? So there are a couple of classic answers. Again, we could spend an entire hour on this, but very briefly, two of the answers that are often given, one is that, well, the nations violated their pact of not overly oppressing us with the Holocaust. So once they violated their pact, so we're not bound by our pact, and therefore we could do whatever we want, we could retake it. And another response that's given is, we didn't take it by force because
the UN gave it to us.
That's one of the most classic answers that we now give when you hear such a discussion about these oaths. A, they already oppressed us overly. They promised not to, and they did. And B, we didn't take it by force. The UN voted. We all saw that footage. Everyone's taking score, keeping track. They gave it to us. There was a partition plan. If you had to ask this question before 1947, before 1940, before the Holocaust, before the UN gave it to us, then it's a different discussion. Can we not? Should we not? Is it appropriate or inappropriate to take it by force? Or is it really ours? And we're just taking back that which really belongs to us. Okay, so far so good? Let's begin. Let us begin. We've got a lot to do. We're going to do it quickly, and we'll try to get back to a lot of these points as we go through. Okay, the origins of the Haganah begin in the early 1900s. The Jews, as we've been discussing over the past couple weeks, are beginning to return in very, very significant numbers to the land of Israel. The early waves of return, the late 1800s already, by the early 1900s, by the early 1920s, be a very significant number of Jews in the land. It is not Arab-controlled, as was appropriately, it was Turkish-controlled, part of the Ottoman Empire, and it had been for several hundred years. So anyone living in the 1800s, you would ask, who's in control of the land of Palestine? Everybody would say, Ottoman Empire. It's been there since my grandfather and his great-grandfather, before anyone can remember, it belongs to the Ottoman Empire. It's part of their land. In the 1900s, late 1910, 1909 specifically, the Jews were beginning to be attacked by their Arab cousins in the land. They had all of these little settlements that were popping up all over through the land, and they were sitting ducks. They were open targets for roaming bands of Arabs who did not appreciate the Jewish immigration and those who were coming in. So they decided they needed a protective form. Force. And so just like in our community, we have, what do they call them? Hearing the community. They're the Citizens Patrol, right? So any group of citizens, when they feel like they're threatened, so they band together and they form some type of... So HaShomer, which was formed in 1909, was the first such group, which had a very, very simple objective, and that was protect. HaShomer, exactly as the name implies, we need to protect ourselves from attack. What eventually happened at the end of World War I, the end of 1918, the League of Nations was formed with a very noble goal of preventing another world war, which they did a not-such-great job at accomplishing. They were going to resolve all the major world disputes. And at that point is when the British first entered the scene. At the end of World War I, taking over in their part of their victory, they were given through the mandate system to administer part of the now-defunct Ottoman Empire, which had been in control until such time as they were able to stand alone. We're familiar, we've discussed a couple weeks ago in Shul, the Balfour Declaration, which was then formalized in the League of Nations, gave Britain control with the objective of creating a national Jewish homeland. It did not mean they were going to create an independent Jewish state. That was not the objective. It was always going to be part of the British Empire. The land was controlled by the British, but it would carve out in their massive land empire, they were going to carve out a national homeland for the Jewish people, which would be under British rule. That was the objective from the mandate. The Arab riots of 1920 to 1921 made it very clear to the Jews that they could not rely not on a small group called HaShomer, nor could they rely on the British to protect them. And what happened after after those riots, the Haganah was formed and functioned until 1929, but without much central authority or leadership. So already into the 1920s, we have a group called Haganah. Haganah, of course, means
defense, protect,
and that's what it was. It was just an elevated form of HaShomer. They began to train, they began to gather arms, all of which, of course, was illegal under British rule, but they were going to protect themselves. That was the main objective. And then the riots of 1929 changed everything. Those were riots began over tensions at the Kotel, at the Western Wall. It actually began over a mechitza. Many, many shuls have been torn apart by over a machlokas, over a mechitza, too high, too low, too much, too little. So there was a mechitza conflict at the wall itself. The Jews put a mechitza up at the wall. And the Arabs viewed that as a change of the status quo, as some type of construction. They were doing something which they weren't allowed to do. They believed that that was the first step in what was going to become a full takeover, and they were going to destroy the mosque and build a shul. And they riled everybody up, and the riots, the infamous riots of 1929, eventually spread from there, led to Hebron, of course, in the massacre of the yeshiva in Hebron. And at that point, the Haganah's role changes dramatically, and it becomes a much larger organization, and nearly all of the Jewish settlements join in. It acquires foreign arms, it begins to develop workshops to create hand grenades and military equipment, and it basically becomes a capable underground army. And so that you now have, under British-controlled Palestine, a militia under the Jewish agency, which was put in place of Palestine at the time to basically create the infrastructure for running this Jewish homeland, is now in control of an armed Jewish militia called the Haganah. What then begins to happen into the 1930s is that the British government becomes very sensitive to the Arab pressures. And the Arab pressures didn't like the fact that Jews were streaming into the land. And so they begin to restrict the number of Jewish immigrants which enter. Now, the Jews at the time, as we've been discussing, are very passionate Zionists who believe that it's time to create a Jewish national homeland and are now being told by the British that they can't come. Well, who are the British? How long have they been here? 1918, right? So we're talking about a people that have started coming in the 1860s, that are already coming back. The first Zionist Congress is in 1903. We've been here for a long time already. It's the 1930s. We're moving along. And all of a sudden the British say, no more Jews. Or they severely restrict who can come. So the Zionists at the time didn't take that. Who are you? This is our national homeland. You are just a colonial power that came in here, relatively speaking, yesterday. And that created a lot of tension. But the Haganah fighters, many of them, the political leaders at the time, Ben-Gurion particularly, implemented a strategy which they called Havlaga. Havlaga means restraint. That was the official policy of the Haganah. The Haganah as a defense force, as a militia, basically was that. It was just a defense force. It was there to protect. But as far as taking any offensive actions against any of the Arabs or the British, it was not part of their mandate. They did not do so. And many of the Haganah fighters were they objected to that. They didn't feel it was moving their cause forward to simply be a reaction to things that were taking place and just to be protective. They needed to actually to do things. They wanted to counterattack against the Arab gangs. And it philosophically fit into what they were trying to break. If you remember, the Zionists, when they came, wanted to create a new Jew. They were finished with the European model of the short, crooked nose, old man, in his books type of Jew. And they wanted to create a strong, powerful, athletic farmer. And this idea of, just don't hurt me. I'm just going to stay here. I don't want to bother anybody. Just if you try to hurt me, then I'll try to protect myself. Didn't fit the picture of what they were trying to create. And so this group, in 1931, just 2 years after the riots, the more militant elements of the Haganah, led by Zev Jabotinsky, splinter off and they form our next group, the Irgun, Irgun Tzva'i Lu'umi, which was a national military organization. They changed the name from a defense group into a military organization, and it became known as either just the Irgun or its acronym Etzel, from the Irgun HaTzva'i Alumai, the Aleph, the Tzadi, and the Lamed, into Etzel with David Raziel was one of its founders, and its policy can be defined, as I have there on the bottom of page one, from the American historian Howard Sasher. The policy of the new organization was based squarely on Jabotinsky's teachings, which called for A, an immediate establishment of the Jewish state, that every Jew had the right to enter Palestine, and only active retaliation would deter the Arabs, and only Jewish armed force would ensure the Jewish state. Those were the principles upon which he stood and upon which this new group took its mandate. Now that means that every Jew, just going through them, because these are important principles that define this group of the Irgun. Number one is an immediate establishment. What is the Jewish agency doing at this time? The Balfour Declaration was back in 1917. In 1921, the League of Nations ratifies it and makes it part of the official policy. We're holding now in 1931. It's been 10 years since it was ratified, 14 years since the original Balfour. And what's happened? Is there a Jewish homeland yet? So you know the Jews. The Jews have become impatient. 14 years is a long time. We waited a long time. So the Irgun breaks off the Haganah. The Haganah is simply defending, working with a policy of diplomacy. When the time is... Now again, nobody knows that in 1947 or 48, you know, what's going to happen. We, in hindsight, can say 31, we're... Nobody knows in 1931 where things are going. Nobody knows the Holocaust is coming. But in 1931, the Irgun breaks off and they say, we need a state now. The only way to get a state is with an active military. Every Jew has a right to come home. And no British policy is going to tell us otherwise. And they created a new national sport. And the national sport of the Irgun was... illegal immigration. And that literally became the objective of how are we going to sneak as many Jews as possible into the land. Because officially the policy from the British was a limited number of immigrants allowed in, and we are going to bring the Jews home. Now again, here we can ask the question that we started with. Good thing, bad thing, how do we view that? So it becomes a funny question, which is really the sensitivity that I want to bring out. This is our homeland. There was another power in control of it at the time, and we created a national sport of, well, that doesn't matter. We're not going to play by that rule. We're going to figure out how to make this work. Now, I'll throw one other thing in. You know, when I'm sure many of you, like I have been, unfortunately, or whenever you have to say that, at the levaya of a survivor, or even when you're talking to a survivor, there's one theme which almost always runs through every survivor's story from the Holocaust. Almost every single one without fail. And that is, when they told me to go right, I went left. I figured out a way to survive. I figured out a way to beat the system. That somehow, those who survived either knew, intuited, figured out, how do you get by? And it's a story you hear, I don't need to repeat them, over and over and over again. And my generation for sure, I'm sure all of you as well, grow up with that sense of we survived because, you know, I got around the system. That's what we needed to do. And that's why we're here. That's why we're here. So what happens when you continuously apply that to living in a society and living with this attitude, with this tradition of, I don't have to play by the rules. It gets very complicated. Very complicated when we look at it and we say, what, you didn't pay your taxes? You can't do that. That's illegal. And the person to whom you're speaking to is thinking, well, the only reason why I'm alive is because I'm illegal. If I would have played by the rules, I'd be dead. I wouldn't have been born. My grandfather and his grandfather would all be dead. So, to balance then it was okay not to play by the rules, but now, you have to play by the rules. So it's easy for me to stand up here and say that, but that's a very complicated system. Well, now the Jews come back to the land of Palestine, and it's controlled by a foreign government. It's controlled by the British, and they say, here are the rules, here's who can come in, and here's who can't come in. And the Jews said, are you kidding me? It's our homeland. And so we started this national sport of we're going to get in everybody who we can. And it's our homeland. And who's going to tell us not to? Well, the British responded to that. And the British said, they created in 1939, after a number of years of this process, what was known as the McDonald White Paper, or just referred to as a white paper, in which they severely restrict their immigration. They came up with a number of 75,000 Jews were going to be allowed in within a five-year period, and then that's it. And then from then on out, only if the Arabs gave permission. So if the local Arabs agreed, then you could bring in more, but otherwise, that's it. And I don't need to tell you, the Jews at the time in the land of Israel saw that as a non-option. 75,000 over 5 years, and then that's it. And then we have to ask the Arabs for permission. That was deeply angering. They also severely limited their ability to purchase land, the Jews that came in the land of Palestine. And that caused all sorts of... There was many things kicked into motion that of plans that were going. The Irgun had all sorts of plans, and then the war broke out in 1939, shortly after the white papers were issued. And Ben-Gurion, at that point, who was the chairman of the Jewish Agency, set the policy, and he said, as follows on the top of page 2, we will fight... Now again, the war broke out, and the Jews understood that the Germans were the enemy, and the British were, I should say, most of the Jews understood this way, and the British, we needed to ally with them to defeat the Germans. And the Jews, therefore, came to an understanding in the land of Palestine of a truce that they would draw up with the British so that the British can focus their efforts on fighting the war. And Ben-Gurion coined the phrase, we will fight the war against Hitler as if there were no white paper. And then we will fight the white paper as if there is no war. So each one needs to be dealt with. Right now there's a war, so we'll pretend as if the British did not establish this white paper policy, and we'll join with the British, support them in defeating Hitler. But then as soon as that ends, we're going to then fight the white paper as if there wasn't a war that we just joined in with you. In reaction to the white paper, this should have been a little bit later, but we'll speak it over now. The Haganah built up what they called the Palmach, which was the Haganah's elite strike force. Now we have a new group on the scene, the Palmach, was a name that's also familiar to all of us. That was under the Haganah, and they became a strike force. So that even though the Haganah generally was a defense force, and the militant hotheads went off and formed the Irgun, then the Haganah, when the white papers came out, formed their own strike force, so that you now had the Palmach, which was functioning under the Jewish Agency as part of the Haganah, which also then began to do its own offensive attacks and helping to organize illegal Jewish immigration to the land of Palestine. They brought in various Jews all under that time. World War II breaks out, moving along. As I mentioned, the basic truce was formed amongst the parties, including the Irgun, with the British, as they're fighting the shared enemy. Except, not all Jews agreed to that either. So what you now had was a joint effort of the Irgun and the Haganah, together with its Palmach, all agreed that they're going to call a truce against the British and let the British alone so that they can fight the Germans. But there was another group of Jews who said, we can't allow that to happen because the British are as great an enemy as the Germans are. And so Avraham Yair Stern breaks off from the Irgun. Now the Irgun already was a military hothead who broke off from Haganah. And then from then, Stern breaks off and says, even during the war, we can't stop the fight against the British, and he forms what's known as the Lehi, the Lochamei Charut Yisrael, those who are fighting for the freedom of the Jewish people. They became known as the Stern Gang, which was not a complimentary term that they were referred to as. And he continues to fight even during the war. Now, he was a very poetic, he was a passionate Zionist. I brought here just one of his poems that he wrote. You'll see there's a very there's a theme in here. You are betrothed to me, my homeland, according to all the laws of Moshe and Yisrael. Now, what's that a phrase from? Right? He's literally taking the phrase of Harei Mekudeshet Li, applying it between him and the land of Israel. And with my death, I will bury my head in your lap, and you will live forever in my blood. So you can feel the passion that he had. All of the leaders of these groups were such passionate Zionists. They believed to the core about the Jewish people's return to the land. And he felt that the Germans were as much an enemy, or I should say the British, were as much an enemy as the Germans. Because the British, again, were limiting immigration. And Jews needed a place to go. And therefore, He actually reached out to Nazi Germany on two different occasions, trying to ally with them. This is before anyone had a clue how bad the Holocaust was going to be. In 1939 and 1940, this is before the final solution. It was bad, but no one knew how bad. And he actually reached out on two different occasions trying to ally them. Of course, Hitler wanted nothing to do with him, but that's a historical fact. The Lehi, they're infamous, probably for the massacre at Deir Yassin, which is itself shrouded in controversy exactly what took place, but it had a very negative political fallout, of course. For the Jews, they assassinated Loren Moyne, who was the British minister resident in the Middle East, who was the highest-ranking official at the time in 1944, which was carried out by both two Elios, Elio Bet-Zuri and Elio Hakim, who were both captured and later executed. And Stern himself was captured. He was on the run, constantly in hiding, and eventually the British captured him in an apartment, I believe it was in Tel Aviv, and then he died. He was shot and killed in that apartment under very, very controversial circumstances. You could read about this. The whole period of this time is very, very fascinating. The British were there when they conducted the search of the apartment. They actually brought in a number of women from the apartment building to be witnesses that they were doing everything according to the letter of the law. And they found him in the apartment, and they handcuffed him. They put him on a couch. And then everybody left. And Avram Stern ended up being left alone with three armed policemen. And then the next thing everybody knows is that three shots rang out and he was dead. The circumstances of that continues to be debated until this day, whether or not he was murdered in cold blood. The British authorities claimed he tried to escape or tried to set off some explosives. But either way, he died in 1944. They continued until 1948. And in 1948, this group known as Lehi was disbanded when the state was formed, the State of Israel, and they were deemed an illegal and terrorist group by the new government. And they disbanded them. They were granted, any member of the Lehi was granted amnesty in 1949, but it continues to be a big flagpole for hard right-wing policy supporters. They identify with this movement of the Lehi, and even in 1980 they were granted a military recognition, the Lehi ribbon for those who served, and its most famous member then became Yitzhak Shamir, who became the Prime Minister even in 1983. What is fascinating is that each one of the leaders of these movements, of the Haganah and the Irgun and the Lehi, all eventually became Prime Ministers of the State of Israel. First Ben Gurion, of course, and then Begin, who led the Irgun, as we'll discuss in a moment, and even Shamir from the Lehi. So as much as they had very different approaches, as we'll continue to get through now as we get into it, each one of the leaders eventually became one of the prime ministers. As we begin Menachem Begin, one more introductory comment. It's really impossible. If we had more time, I would show a clip. If you Google Irgun, and you go home tonight, and you Google Irgun, you'll come up, you'll see 1,000 videos, and almost none of them will be from a Jewish perspective. I think it's really almost impossible to understand the modern form of anti-Semitism that we have today, that we fight today, which is anti-Israel, without understanding what we're now going to, which is really the heart of the matter, which we're going to get into right now, which is the period of the Irgun and Menachem Begin and his approach to the land. Because if you watch, just to see the other side, like how does the world view us? So the world viewed the Irgun as a terrorist organization. And they attribute the modern manifestation of terrorism, which we fight every day of Israel's existence now, the world out there traces it to this period of our history, early 1940s until the founding of the state, and says, and you will hear this, terrorism was born in Israel by the Irgun and at the hands of the Jews. And now they're living with what they created. Now that's a harsh statement, but it's an important one to understand what we're dealing with when the anti-Semitism. You can't deal with something without knowing your enemy. So it's fascinating. So the answer is what I started with. When we talk about the land, the starting point always is, Where's the starting point? Where does the story begin about the land of Israel? So we begin with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and before that, the very first Rashi in Chumash. This is God's land. He gave it to whom we chose. This is our land. The entire starting point of the Zionist enterprise is, we're going home. This is ours. We're sitting in exile in a place that we don't belong, in a place where we have no future. We're just waiting to go home. And for 2,000 years, Jews sat on the floor in Tisha B'Av and mourned, L'shana Abav Yerushalayim. It's our land. If you don't start there, if you just start and say, well, I don't know, the Ottoman Turks have been here for 500 years, who are you to come and take it from the local Arab inhabitants? You're just starting from a very different starting point. And let's leave it there. Let's go on a little bit because it gets even more confusing as we go along. I missed one thing that I wanted to say before we get to Menachem Begin. If you flip to the very back side of your page, page five, a couple of addendums. Now, the Lehi used terror all the time. They were actively fighting when they broke off from the Irgun, even during the war years, so they justified what they were doing. And I want to share this as we go through this process. They write, this is the article, top of the page is an article from their underground newspaper. Neither Jewish ethics nor Jewish tradition can disqualify terrorism as a means of combat. If you're using terrorism as combat, there's nothing wrong with that. When is terrorism a problem? If you're using it against innocent civilians to instill or to gain some political objective. But in war, war is hell. It just is. We are very far from having any moral qualms as far as our national war goes. They said, we're in a national war. We have before us the command of the Torah, whose morality surpasses that of any other body of laws in the world. You shall blot them out to the last man. So they take a passage from the Torah that you have to destroy all the wickedness and Amalek. Timcheh et zecher Amalek. Now that's a reference to Amalek. And they use it in their arguments of, we have to blot out the British, anyone who's preventing us from forming our homeland. But first and foremost, terror is for us a part of the political battle being conducted under the present circumstances, and it has a great part to play, speaking in a clear voice to the whole world, as well as to our wretched brethren outside this land who are going through the Holocaust. It proclaims our war against the occupier. We are particularly far from this sort of hesitation in regard to an enemy whose moral perversion is admitted by the British. Well, their morality we don't have to question. So what are they arguing here? It's a very important argument. Number one, that they're at war. When did this war start? So they held that the British occupation, preventing immigration, was an act of war. Now, Israel's not a state yet, but that they are fighting a national war on behalf of the Jewish people. Look at Yitzhak Shamir. Next box. After they were taken to task, they assassinated Clifford Martin, who was a British intelligence corps sergeant. Says Yitzhak Shamir, there are those who say that when we killed him, that's terrorism. He says, but to attack an army camp, that's guerrilla warfare, and to bomb civilians is professional warfare. Says Yitzhak Shamir, but I think it is the same from the moral point of view. What difference is it whether or not you're attacking an army or you're an army attacking civilians? What are in World War II, every single army involved attacked innocent civilians all day long. What did the U.S. do to end the war? Says Yitzhak Shamir, is it better to drop an atomic bomb on a city than to kill a handful of specific people? I don't think so. Nobody says that President Truman was a terrorist. All the men we went for individually, Wilkin, Martin, McMichael, and others, were personally interested in succeeding in the fight against us. So Lehi defends their approach of actively attacking and assassinating and going after the British we're at war. That's worse than dropping an atomic bomb and killing 100,000 innocent civilians in a second? Why is it any difference? It was more efficient and more moral. He's even taking the moral high ground to go for selected targets. In any case, it was the only way that we could operate because we were so small. And you could see, and he says, we have other examples, he says, even from the Torah itself, Gidon and Shimshon, and all of these things influenced our thinking. Okay, which leads us to the 1940s. And Menachem Begin, back to page 2. By the time he comes on the scene, Jabotinsky has already died in New York in 1940 while he was fundraising. Raziel was killed, who was an original founder of the Irgun in Iraq in 1941. And Begin, who is a Polish Jew, was born in 1913 on Shabbos Nachamu, which is an interesting thing. Shabbos Nachamu, of course, the Shabbos after Tisha B'Av, and he was named by his parents Menachem for being born on Shabbos, which means to console. And he who's going to bring really on the forefront of the Jewish return to the land of Israel was born in Shabbos Nachamu in 1913. He was a very unusual intellectual capacity, brilliant, brilliant person. He was a brilliant orator. He was a natural leader. He was educated in a very Jewish way, as we see from all of his writings, finished law school in 1935, and was very profoundly affected by his personal contact with Jabotinsky. He saw in him the faith, the vision, and the pride, the courage. These were all things which were new-ish to the Jewish people in the 20s and 30s of courage and action and pride in the Jewish return to the land. He was the head of the Beitar Youth Movement in Poland, and then in Czechoslovakia. He spent some time, he was arrested by the Soviets and later freed. He wrote about it in his book, White Nights, which you could read about if you're interested. By 1943, he makes his way to Israel and almost immediately is placed in charge of the Irgun. Yeah, it's in the middle of the war. And he begins commander-in-chief. I saw somewhere that it took him a while to get, he was such a stickler for policy that he didn't take over right because he was still officially enlisted in, the Polish or the, one of the armies. And since Tully actually was officially discharged, he wouldn't take control of the Irgun, but eventually he did. Now, by this time in 1943, the war had turned, and it seemed to be just a matter of time until the Allies were going to emerge victorious. And not only that, but the images began to filter out of what was going on. The level of the atrocities of the Holocaust began to become known at that time. And at that time, and I have at the bottom here a quote from Yehuda Avner in his book, because he just says it so poetically, newsreels are showing the British Navy intercepting leaking boats of Jewish survivors off the shore of Palestine and turning them back or interning them. Some of the pitiful vessels, searching in vain for safe harbor, went down with their wretched cargo. Is it any wonder that a man of the stuff of Menachem Begin, driven by an inexpressible anguish, burst forth and with more audacity than armory, led his small but well-entrenched Irgun underground army in a perilous revolt against the British in Palestine? What happens here is a shift. Until now, there have been two groups. You have the Haganah, which is a defense force primarily. They have the Palmach, which really started in 1939 with the white paper, but is primarily a defense force. And you have the Irgun, which functioned for a few years, which was, we have to be more proactive, we have to show the Arabs that we mean business and show the British that we mean business, but it was limited in scope. And it was about founding the states. How should we found the state? Should it be active? Should it be with aggression? Should it be with military might? Or should it be with diplomacy? Now, that argument has existed in Jewish history for a long time. During the times of the Second Temple, during the siege of the Romans already, there were two groups of Jews who lived in the time who debated whether or not we should fight the Romans or whether or not we should just wait them out. And if you're familiar with the story, the Jews had enough supplies within the walled cities of Jerusalem to last 3 years. But those who wanted to fight said, we can't just sit here like sitting ducks. We need to fight these people. And as long as there's food, you're never going to do it. So what do? They burn down all of the supplies in order to inspire their fellow Jews to fight the Romans, which of course led to a disaster and famine, and eventually the walls fell and the Jewish people rose. But the two ideas of how do we defend ourselves, do we fight or do we wait it out, it's always been a debate amongst the Jewish people. But in 1943, something changes. And there's another element which enters, which fundamentally changes the entire nature of the game. We had a very small group of the Irgun. The Irgun was not very large. Never, according to estimates, had more than 1,000 people in it. Haganah was the mainstay. But in 1943, the war has turned, and the British are turning away ships. And now it becomes a different game. Because now there are Jewish refugees, not just Jews who want to come out of Europe. We now have refugees coming out of the Holocaust who have nowhere to go, who are being slaughtered. And the images that we're seeing are the British, who've been here for 10 minutes, turning them away to their deaths. And that's a game changer. It was a game changer to Begin. It was a game changer to the Jewish people. One such example, in February of 1942, which is right before Begin comes on the scenes, the Struma was torpedoed in the Black Sea. The Irgun had arranged a cargo ship, really. It was for animals. It was a decrepit ship that was going to leave from Romania. They crammed it. It was fitted for 150 people, passengers. They crammed 770 Jewish passengers onto the ship out of Romania. It was the last ship to leave Europe during the war years. It got stranded in Turkey because its engine broke down repeatedly, and they were stuck in Turkey waiting for papers from the British to enter into the land of Palestine. They were there for several weeks with almost no food or water. Turkey would not let them get off the boat because none of them had papers and none of them were legal to be in Turkey. Britain would not allow them to go to Palestine, and Romania didn't want them back, and so they were stuck in no man's land. And eventually, Turkey cut their anchor and forcibly dragged the ship out to the Baltic Sea. The captain yelling and screaming, "We're not capable of just being out here." And the next day, they were torpedoed by a Russian submarine, who history later proved that Stalin had given the orders to sink any neutral ship in the Baltic Sea at the time. And 768 of the 769 Jews died in the frozen water or during the explosion. The one survivor is a Jew by the name of David Stolier. You could look him up online. He was interviewed a bunch of times and told the story of being the sole survivor. He lost his fiance and her two parents amongst all of the Jews that were on that ship. And it all came down to the fact that Britain wouldn't allow them in. That's why the whole thing happened. These were the events that it wasn't enough that Hitler's doing what he's doing in Europe. We got them out. The Irgun bought a ship, outfitted, put all the Jews on it, got them to where they needed to go, and then they can't come home. And that was really just too much.
Yeah, we had to play the role of the Arabs here. Because you are putting all the blame on the British.
That's right.
And so the British had the pressure from the Arabs.
100%. The British were caught between the Arab sensitivities who were indigenous to the lands. 100%. That's why, as I said, it's a very, very complicated story. When we look at the story from our perspective, this is our land. This is home. We've been praying for this for 2,000 years. Well, the British didn't see it that way. The British saw their mandate to protect the indigenous Arab population who didn't like the fact that the Jews were coming, and they, you know, had to deal with whatever that they were dealing with. But Begin takes a look at all that's taking place, and even though it was total lunacy to challenge the British in 1942 and 1943, he did so with one underground message which he just went over with over and over and over again, and that was: as long as the British mandatory barred the gates of suffering Jews desperately needing to immigrate from Europe, Britain would remain the enemy of the Jewish people. And that, again, is a shift in the Irgun, not just from, we believe active warfare is a better method. It was no longer just a preference of, should we use diplomacy or should we attack? It was, there are Jewish refugees being slaughtered in Europe and you're not letting them come. And as long as you're not letting them come, you are the enemy of the Jewish people. Let me read to you from his manifesto of revolt. He writes as follows, Begin: "We are at the last stage of the war. We stand before a historical decision and the fate of generations. There is no longer any armistice between the Jewish people and the British administration." Because again, remember, they made a peace treaty in 1939 when the war broke out. And the Irgun said, "We're not going to attack because we need you to fight the Germans." But now it's 4 years later, it's 1943, the war has turned, and now we need you to let our refugees come home. And you're not. Our people are at war with the British regime. war to the end. Our fighting youth will not be deterred by sacrifice, torment, blood, and suffering. They will never surrender, nor shall they rest until our days of old are restored, and until our homeland, our freedom, our sustenance, and justice have been secured. And this then is our demand: immediate transfer of power to a provisional Jewish government. We shall fight, every Jew in the homeland shall fight. The God of Israel, the Lord of hosts, is with us. There shall be no retreat, freedom, or death. And that was his manifesto of this is our homeland, God will be with us, and we're at war. And we will fight to the death with the British regime. Now, again, if you were the British government, did you view yourself at war with the Jews in the land of Palestine? No, the British would not have seen themselves at war. They came in, they had a mandate to create a Jewish homeland, which they, I don't know, I can't say whether or not they thought they were on their way to do, they were planning on doing, I don't know, it hadn't happened yet. But they wouldn't have seen themselves at war with the Jews. But what do the Jews view themselves as? At least the Irgun, I should say. Literally at war. When you're at war, the terms of engagement are different than if you're not at war. And Begin in 43, with watching the ships being turned around, said, this is war. Our people need to be able to come home. Now Ben-Gurion fought this tooth and nail every step of the way, and he said, diplomacy, diplomacy, diplomacy. Patience. We're working. The Jewish agency is here. We're developing infrastructure. We're getting ready. Now again, nobody knew that it was just going to be 47, 48, a few years later. Nobody knew that. Nobody knew what was going to be at the end of the war still. But his policy was continuously restraint and restraint and restraint. And the Irgun is saying, what do you mean restraint? How many boats do you want turned around? How many more Jews have to die at sea after surviving Hitler before we bring them home? So in 1944, the Irgun goes to war. They carry out all sorts of underground operations. Immigration offices are simultaneously attacked in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Haifa. They follow that with attacks on the income tax offices, British intelligence and police headquarters. Four were simultaneously attacked on Yom Kippur of 1944. If you remember, on Yom Kippur, I spoke about what took place with the shofar blowing at the Kotel on Yom Kippur, and where Begin made a whole big to-do how the British policemen did not want to allow the shofar blowing to take place on Yom Kippur. And Begin, for 10 days from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, said any British soldier or policeman who stops the shofar blowing will be treated as a criminal and will be treated appropriately, and everybody's up in arms. And then the shofar blast happened. Meanwhile, the whole thing was a ruse, because on that Motzei Yom Kippur, in four different locations, the Irgun fighters were blowing up police headquarters while everybody was looking out at the Kotel to what was going on. And all of their attacks were against British installments, against military installments, against symbols of power, against bridges. They were not attacking as civilians, but the British army, which they felt they were at war with. And because of all of this, Begin becomes the most wanted man, who they referred to, of course, as a terrorist in the British Empire. If you read Yehuda Avner's book, which is an awesome book, you all must read it. If you don't have time to read the whole thing, it's pretty big. Just read the first 20 pages. The first 20 pages, he describes what Israel was like in the early 1940s, pre-state, during this time of Menachem Begin and Britain, because Yehuda Avner himself was still in England at the time. And he describes what it was like to be a British Jew when the English people are up in arms about a Jewish terrorist causing all sorts of problems in just this, there's a little land of Palestine that we're controlling, and some terrorist Jewish group, who they all refer to as a terrorist Jewish group, was causing all of these problems, and the riots that broke out in England against shuls and schools and what it was like to be a Jew. So all of that is described in beautiful detail in the beginning of his, in his book. Now,
did the action of the Irgun and the Lehi, okay, help bring more Jews?
Oh, for sure it helped bring more Jews, yeah. Oh, without question. They were very successful. They were sneaking them in.
Oh, sneaking. But,
oh, legally, no, because the white papers are still in.
Why attack them? If you sneak is one thing, but attacking.
So they were trying to weaken, because if the last paragraph that we read in his manifesto was, we don't need to just sneak them in, we need to get rid of, in other words, if I'm putting my hand in, so instead of just trying to get through my finger, get rid of the hands. So they felt that the British were an occupying force in their land. Their immigration policy was tantamount to murder, because Jews are dying because of it. So we're going to do two things. We're going to try to sneak in as many as we can, and they were very successful at that. And we're going to get rid of you. And so they attacked every installment that they could, which would weaken and eventually get them out. There's going to be a comment that I'm going to make in a few minutes. I'll make it right now. There's a fundamental difference between the resolve of a people fighting for its soul, fighting for its life, and fighting for its land, versus a people ruling over a mandated territory of theirs. The British soldiers that were there are British soldiers stationed in the land of Palestine. The Jews of Palestine are fighting for their soul, are fighting for their life, and fighting for their land.
Like Vietnam, wait, the Americans.
Right? So I'm sure there are a lot of examples in world history. Who's going to outlast who in that kind of battle? So the British look at us as like, you guys are a bunch of terrorists. That's how the British, they repeatedly, terrorists, terrorists, terrorists. Like, what are you doing? We're in control. We're going to carve out this legal. And the Jews are like, this is our home. This is our home. These are our people. And when you add again that last element of 43 of, and our Jews are dying because they can't come home, so then there's no end. There's no limit to what...
Even after the war, they didn't let them in.
Correct, that's what we're going to get to. So then already it's a different story. When you're watching Jews die who made it out of Europe, so there's no end. There's no end to what you'd be willing to do. And that's what takes place. Now, the British strike back. Again, so following all the revved-up attacks that the Irgun launch against the British strike back. And what they start doing is they begin publicly flogging and hanging Irgun fighters that they captured, and some of which are against regular protocol. Again, if you read Yehuda Avner's Prime Minister, he describes what happened in Akko when they would capture the Irgun fighters, and without trial, without notifying families, they would just hang them. So Begin, so everything is, this is, you know, how things go. Begin's attacking the British, and he says, I didn't start this, you started this. You put all this limitation on immigration. Our Jews are dying. We're not going to stand. So they attack all the British installments. The British say, what in the world are you doing? We're not going to stand for this. And they begin capturing Irgun fighters. And if you've ever been to all these museums in Israel, they have all of these memorials to many of the Irgun fighters that were captured and hung. And Begin responds, you're going to hang our Jews? Flogging for flogging, hanging for hanging. Every single time that anything happens to a Jew, we're going to do the exact same thing to a British soldier. If you read his quotes, we recognize, it's in the box on the bottom of page 2, we recognize no one-sided laws of war. If the British are determined that their way out of the country should be lined with the avenue of the gallows and of weeping fathers and mothers, wives and sweethearts, we shall see to it that in this there shall be no racial discrimination. The gallows will not be of one color. The price will be paid in full. And that's what happened. As things escalate, every time a Jew, Irgun fighter, was caught and hung, or hanged, we were talking about that, a British soldier would be kidnapped and then hanged as well. And one of the most famous, they captured two British soldiers, and they were hanged in a eucalyptus garden or an orange grove somewhere in the land, and that was in the front pages of all the British newspapers. And that really, that was an event that changed things, because what they did at that point was the hunting season began. And when the Irgun began this policy of saying, you know, body for body, hanging for hanging, flogging for flogging, the Haganah distanced themselves from that. And the Haganah said, you know, this is too much. We're not at war. Ben-Gurion was very adamant about diplomacy and patience. The war is about to end. Wait till the war to end, and they're never going to be on our side. We need them, and you're waging this terrorist war against them. So the Haganah began became known as the hunting season. And they initiated a massive persecution of the Irgun, which was aimed at putting an end to its activities. This is the Haganah against the Irgun. I want to read to you the official announcement. This is on top of page 4, because this is really... If you were a Jew, again, we're looking in hindsight. We're looking post-Holocaust, post-state. We're already 70 years afterwards. Try to put yourself in 1944, and you're a Jew living in the streets of Yerushalayim or Tel Aviv. Whose side are you on? It's very complicated, again, because you are watching boats being turned away, and you're watching British soldiers being assassinated and kidnapped and hung up. And they're complicated. And then the Histadrut makes this official announcement. Top of page 4. The perpetrators of terror, who call themselves the Irgun and the Lehi, are traitors. They must be removed from our classrooms, banished from our workshops. Their propaganda, whether written or spoken, must not be permitted. No refuge must be given to these malefactors in the homes of your parents, relatives, or acquaintances. The incorrigible despoilers must be isolated and abandoned until they are spewed out of the ranks of the Yishuv, until terror ceases and its organization is eradicated. So they start off, this is bad for the Jews. They're terrorists and they're traitors. The Jewish agency proposes herewith that all persons who are acquainted with any of the terrorists should immediately inform the police by word of mouth, in writing or by telephone, and observe the injunction, and thou shalt root out the evil from thy midst. What's that a quote from? From the Chumash, "Ubi'arta hara mikirbecha." The Torah says, when you have evil, root it out. So the Haganah, the Histadrut, puts out a notice. If you have a terrorist in your home, now again, using the term terrorist, from the Irgun or from the Lehi, they are a traitor to the Jewish people, and you have to root out the evil. Fathers who have sons in these organizations, which generation would you say would be part of the Irgun and the Lehi? The older generation or the younger generation? Fathers who have sons in these organizations, in the same fashion, please inform the police and observe thereby the injunction. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, he must take him out to the elders and say to them, "This our son is stubborn and rebellious, he does not obey our voice, and the men of the city shall stone him with stones." What are they bringing in now? Ben-Sor and Mor, they're saying, we know about this. Children, we have a long-standing tradition. The Torah tells us how to deal with a rebellious son. Kill him. Now, the Torah, the Gemara itself says there never was such a thing as a rear Ben Sor or Ben Morer. But what is the Histadrut saying? They're saying, your son thinks he's being a hero. He thinks by attacking the British and by hanging their soldiers, he's going to win freedom. Just the opposite. He's being a terrorist and a traitor. And if he's your son, turn him over. What do you think is going on inside the homes of the Jews in 1944 in Palestine right now? I mean, it's impossible for us to imagine. You're an immigrant, a Zionist who moved in 1920 on the promise of a new land. And you got married, Baruch Hashem, you had a boy. It's now 1944. You're living on a kibbutz. You're living out your dream, and your son, who's now 20, joins the Irgun. This is what happened. I mean, a lot of them came over from Europe, obviously, without any parents. But the Jews, many, many Jews immigrated in the 1910s, teens, 20s. They all now have children in their late teens and early 20s who are probably members of the Irgun and the Lehi. And then your parent organization that you've been tilling the land for and supporting says to you, turn your kid over. He's a terrorist. He's a threat to the Jewish people. He's a threat for everything that you've worked for the last 25 years. Particularly since the English do not intend to do the terrorists any harm. They will hold them for a year or two apart from other people until their surplus energy, which apparently results from overeating and from inactivity and sloth, has cooled down. It is time to act for the sake of the Jewish people and their homeland. But again, I just want to stress the tension here. The Haganah, the Histadrut, Ben-Gurion is saying, these groups, the Lehi and the Irgun, they're a threat to the Jewish survival, they're a threat to the Jewish people, because the British are going to respond and they're going to try to get rid of all of us. And they're terrorists on top. And the Irgun and the Lehi are saying, saw that ship? You know how many Jews just died because of your British friends? There's only one way out of this, freedom or death. Oh, try figuring that one out. How you're supposed to handle that. Well, the Haganah then launched this hunting season, and they actually went out and they turned over their brothers to the British, nearly 1,200 Irgun fighters and other political enemies of the Haganah. Now, Haganah had a lot of political enemies. Ben-Gurion was a tough cookie, he had a long memory and a lot of enemies, and he was married to his vision, and if he didn't fit in his vision, he had a lot of political enemies. So 1,200 fighters and enemies of the Haganah were turned over to the British. And Begin, in one of two instances, I'm sorry, it's later, but I'm going to try to finish up quickly. In one of two instances, prevented a civil war. And that is that he did not fight back. And even though it was the Haganah that was leading this hunting season, he instructed his men not to attack and fight. Jew does not fight other Jew. That was one of his policies. We did not survive 2,000 years of exile to attack other Jews. And the Irgun tried to hide, but they did not fight back. And he prevented a civil war for sure by doing so. Now, he, besides for his theological belief in fighting a civil war, he also believed that the Haganah would come around when the war finally ended and the British didn't do anything to change the white papers, that even the Haganah would realize that they needed to fight the British. And that's exactly what happened. In 1945, the war ends. Churchill is voted out of office within a month of the war ending, which is the classic response of gratitude for all that he did. And the new elected government made absolutely no changes to the white papers. They put them right back where they were, limiting immigration. If the Arabs agree, yes, but otherwise, no more immigration. This is right after the war. Now the full brunt of what took place in Europe is known. Jewish refugees everywhere, nowhere to go. And Palestine is not a place where they can come. So then there was a united response. This is the one time that all three groups joined together. Lehi, Irgun, and Haganah all joined together. And they carried out a number of missions in 1945 and 1946. They hit train stations, bridges, police stations. They go all out in a coordinated effort. Now it's agreed the British are the enemy of the Jewish people. If the war is over, and where Europe, all that's left is survivors. There's no normal community left in all of Europe. Where are the survivors going to go? DP camps. We have a homeland. British says no. At that point, everybody joins together, and all three groups fight the British. And that leads to the Black Sabbath, as we refer to it, as the British refer to it as Operation Agatha. On June 29th, 1946, in which an approximate number of 17,000 British soldiers flood the country, and they go door to door, arresting anyone affiliated with these groups. 2,700 Jews are arrested, their weapons are confiscated, and more importantly, they confiscate all sorts of information and papers. They raid the Jewish agency headquarters, and they confiscate all sorts of papers from there as well. Now, continuing Begin's flogging for flogging, hanging for hanging, whatever you do, we're going to do back. And that is the background to the famous, infamous King David Hotel bombing, which takes place exactly less than a month after the Black Sabbath, when all of these raids take place against the Jewish organizations. They then, in a joint organization, arrange for the bombing of the King David Hotel. It's a response to the Black Sabbath. The Haganah approved the mission, though they later claimed that they withdrew it when they wanted to distance themselves from the aftermath of the bombing. The reason why the Black King David Hotel was chosen was because it was taken over by military and administrative headquarters for the British Mandatory Authority. And since you attacked the Jewish agency, which was our headquarters, we're going to attack your headquarters. As you're all familiar, we'll mention it very, very briefly. It is shrouded in controversy. The facts are clear. The Irgun fighters planted a number of bombs in milk canisters that they snuck into the basement pretending to be kitchen staff. The fact is they did call and warned the British three times. That's a fact. What everything then breaks down is whether or not the warnings were given to the right people, whether or not they knew to take them seriously. If you want to read up about it, it's a fascinating history. The British claim nobody with authority received it. Maybe the switchboard operator in the hotel received the warning, but what was she supposed to do? There was nothing in place, and we received bomb threats all the time. So how are we supposed to know that this one was serious? There wasn't enough time. Bottom line is 91 people die All of them, almost all of them, not even soldiers. 17 Jews even were amongst the dead. There were over 40 Arabs who were killed. And it has the very, very ominous identification of being the first major international terrorist act of post-World War II. And again, when I say, if you want to understand Jewish anti-Semitism, that bombing is pointed to as the first international act of terrorism to further a political agenda. Begin, to his dying day, defended the act, saying we were at war, saying it was a military establishment, saying we warned them, and all the proofs of that. At the end of the day, 90 people die, another 20 were injured, and that, again, dramatically shifted the sands of the time of what was going on. Immediately after that, Ben-Gurion, at that point they were joint. Ben-Gurion then separates himself from Begin and the Irgun, defines them as a terrorist organization and an enemy of the Jewish people, and that was the end of their partnership. One last thing to discuss is the famous Altalina, which you're all familiar with as well. Just with all that we've spoken about tonight, the background of this is that in 1947, when the UN votes to partition the land into two separate states, and then independence is declared in May of 1948, Begin announces the disbanding of the Irgun, that the Irgun's objectives were met, that we now have a state. I gave to you his speech. It's a gorgeous speech. It's worth reading. It's on page at the end, your last two pages. It's a long speech. It's worth it. It's really, really beautiful. Let me just actually read the underline. There's one underline piece that I want to on the bottom of page 6. You see where I am? The Irgun is leaving the underground inside the boundaries of the Hebrew independent state. We went underground, we arose in the underground under a rule of oppression in order to strike at oppression and to overthrow it, and right well have we struck. And now, for the time being, we have a Hebrew rule in part of our homeland, and as in this part there'll be Hebrew law, and that's the only rightful law in this country. There's no need for a Hebrew underground in the state of Israel. We're not going to be underground. We're now soldiers and builders. And then they expect the government will respect them. And so he basically disbanded the Irgun, which not everybody expected him to do. And not everybody believed he would actually do, because the Irgun and the Haganah have been fighting each other. But he announced that they were done. Now, what happened with the Altalina is it was supposed to arrive. It was arranged by Irgun fighters in Europe. And it was stocked with a tremendous amount of ammunition and nearly 900 fighters. The ships left from, I forgot where, from Italy, I believe. Is it Italy? With 900 fighters and weaponry. When it left, it was under the Irgun. It was financed by the Irgun and staffed by the Irgun, but it was delayed in arriving. It was supposed to arrive in Palestine in May of 48, early May of 48. It was delayed for various reasons, as delays happen, and it arrived at the end of May or the beginning of June. Well, what happened in the middle of May? The states declared, and Ben-Gurion says, the Irgun is done. We don't exist anymore. Well, now you have a great Talmudic question. What happens to a ship that was organized by the Irgun, paid for by the Irgun, filled with 900 Irgun fighters, filled with ammunition, that was Irgun ammunition, and when it left? And by the time it arrives, the Irgun doesn't exist. Who owns all of the ammunition and the weaponry?
The state.
Ah, so here you had a debate. So Begin arranged with Ben-Gurion and said, give us 20% and send it to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim still was not as clear. It's not so easy to take different organizations and divide them up. It took a little bit of time, and this is just 2 or 3 weeks' time. So Begin said, give me 20% of the stuff, and then you can, for my fighters in Yerushalayim, who still have their own little pockets, and we're still fighting with what was going on there in 48 in Yerushalayim, and you can take the rest. Meanwhile, when the ship arrives, you can read the history, who said what, when, where, how. Ben-Gurion wanted the whole thing, and a fight breaks out. There was actually literally a firefight. There were about 40 Jews who died in the firefight. And then the ship was shelled by the Haganah fighters. actually shelled the ship, caught fire, and they had to abandon the ship. It was all to do. 40 people die in the fight, and Begin, for the second time, prevented a civil war by, again, instructing all of his... Again, they're literally 2 weeks away from him declaring that we're no longer the Irgun. A very complicated, you know, you try to get, like, you know, if you can imagine in a much simpler thing, two shuls joined together, and within 2 weeks, you know, there's a major, you know, selling of product. Like, how does that work? So, and this is fighting for your lives. This is, you know, they have a war that's about to break out. Literally, when they declare independence, they're fighting a war. All these ammunition is coming. The government says, we need it all. And they're going to say, we organized all of this. Our fighters need it. Our fighters are your fighters. And that was a very dark day amongst the Jewish people, that, you know, 40 Jews should die at the hands of other Jews over all of this. In summary... Yeah. In summary, I think, you know, again, this is far more than we can discuss. It took a little bit longer than an hour. I apologize. Far more than the tip of the iceberg. Each one of these stories is a story into itself. I hope it's encouraged and inspired you just to read more about any of the individual episodes that we discussed. The controversy in Jewish history is, can you imagine being there during this time, and you have, you know, the Palmach, you have Lehi, you have the Irgun, you have the Haganah, each one standing for something else. And if you ask the question, who is right? Which was the way to go about our freedom? So the answer is, I'm certainly not going to answer that question. There is no answer to that question. What happened was, they each played a critical role. Had it not been for the Haganah, the Jewish agency, and the Histadrut, that was really the bulk of the Jewish world, overwhelming majority of the numbers and the supporters, and they were fully responsible for all the infrastructure. Without them, there's no state in 1948, there's no infrastructure, there's no government, there's nothing ready. Would that state have come about in 1948 without the British saying, enough of this?
No.
What happened? In 1947, they basically said, we've had enough of these terrorist Jews, and they handed it back to the UN and said, you deal with it, we're out of here. And then the UN voted. So to say, what I started with, well, it's ours because the UN gave it to us. Not really historically accurate. It's true that the UN voted to give it to us after Jewish groups terrorized the British to the point when the British said, Gedichtstein, we're done. We don't want it anymore. And they gave it back to the UN. And the UN said, well, what do you want us to do with it? Okay, we'll split it up and let the Jews and Arabs fight it over for themselves. And they basically wiped their hands of it and said, you know, we're done. So it's true they voted. So when you look back at it, neither one could have... who knows what would have happened had it not been for the Irgun and the Lehi with the Haganah? Would the British have ever eventually left and given it to a UN vote?
It's a little bit like last week of Ralph Cook saying, I couldn't do what I do if you didn't do
correct.
It.
So it's a complicated stage of our history. The world views Lehi and Irgun as terrorists. They view them as a terrorist organization because there was no war. The British were in control. They had been given the mandate by the League of Nations to control the land, and this underground group terrorized them instead of just living by the law of the land. And the Arabs were the local population. The world, when they point to the origins of terrorism in the 20th century, the world points to the Irgun and Lehi and says, that's where it started, and every other group saw that it worked, and they're just mimicking what the Jews did. The Jews look at the same events and say, home. We just want to go home. And when you add to that, again, as I said, in 43, when Begin comes, and it's no longer we just want to go home, it's that our brethren are dying because they can't come home, then that added that element. All the while, Ben-Gurion and the Haganah saying, no terrorism. It needs to be diplomacy and patience. With a brief period in which they joined in 1945 when the white papers were not rescinded, but eventually went back to diplomacy. And eventually that's what won out. And Begin, you know, throws up the white flag and says, we were successful. Our war, which he kept calling it a war, has yielded the Jewish state. And again, he was kept... afterwards, and again, I've gone too late already. Afterwards, there were many ramifications. Many of the Irgun and Lehi fighters were barred from all sorts of political positions, from joining the army, because Ben-Gurion had a long memory and said, you guys are the enemy, you're terrorists, and we don't want you. And it wasn't until late 70s that Begin eventually is elected prime minister. Rabin is not till... Shamir is not till 83. But eventually, as I said, all the leaders of these three groups eventually become a prime minister. And in the eyes of the world, they said, the Jewish state elected a terrorist to be their head of state. That's what they said. And it's something that if we're not at least, again, with different perspectives, different floors, we view it very differently, obviously. But to not be aware of that is not to be historically sensitive to the fact that complicated episodes in history can be viewed very differently from different players. And the world views it that way. And so to ignore that and just to say, like, Jew haters is at least to be aware of, and again, I'm not even doing this justice, this is just skimming the tip of the iceberg, but hopefully that was the tip of the iceberg. It's a fascinating time in history again. I hope I did it justice, and we'll meet next week, and we'll then talk about how we commemorate the Holocaust in modern times, dealing with tragedy in a new home and state that we were blessed to have. See you next week.